From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Douglas Glover, originally from Canada and now a resident of the great state of Vermont. Douglas Glover has published 4 novels, 5 story collections, and 3 works of nonfiction. His novel Elle won the Governor General's Award for Fiction and was a finalist for the International Impact Dublin Literary Award. It was adapted for the stage by Severn Thompson and premiered in 2016. His short fiction has appeared in Best Canadian Stories and the Best American Short Stories. He edited the annual Best Canadian Stories from 1996 to 2006, and he published the literary magazine Numero 5 from 2010 to 2017. Here's a little information about his new book, Why Do We Read? What do we cherish in a book? What is the nature of a masterpiece? What do Alice Munro, Albert Camus, and the great Polish experimentalist Witold Gombrowicz have in common? In the tradition of Nabokov, Calvino, and Kundera, Douglas Glover's new essay collection fuses his long experience as an author with his love of philosophy and his passion for form. Call it a new kind of criticism or an operator's manual for readers and writers, The Erotics of Restraint extends Glover's long and deeply personal conversation with great books and their authors. With the same dazzling mix of emotion and idea that characterizes his fiction, he dissects narrative and shows us how and why it works, why we love it, and how that makes us human. Erudite and obsessively detailed, inventive, confessional, and cheeky, these essays offer a brilliant clarity, a respite in an age of doubt. They raise the bar. As I prepared for the interview, I came across that reference to Doug Glover's background in philosophy as well as literature, and I asked him to talk about that background as it relates to his work, and that's where we began. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
First of all, my background is, you know, I grew up on a farm in southern Ontario, and I went to a university in Toronto, York University, and I went into philosophy mainly with the idea that I did want to be a writer, but that I didn't like English literature as a subject, you know, as a discipline, didn't do very well at it, thought that I'd be happier filling my mind full of concrete stuff, thoughts, instead of just reading the books, the literature. So I studied philosophy, and then I went to the University of Edinburgh, and I got to do graduate work, and I got very interested in Immanuel Kant and studied him quite carefully, wrote my dissertation on him. And then I taught philosophy for a year at the University of New Brunswick, and then I hated it. Oh. I didn't like teaching. I was very uncomfortable teaching. In some ways, I didn't understand the power dynamics.
Were you too young?
I was very young, yes. Yeah. I was 22 when I started teaching.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And I was a romantic, so I went down, started working at the local newspaper, the local daily newspaper, for I think $75 a week, because I was untrained. I loved that for a while. So the two things, you know, very practical kind of writing experience. Newspapers taught me form at a very rudimentary level.
Right.
And at the same time, I had done philosophy, which was very abstract. And that's kind of formative. And I think you find that in my essays. There's a combination of the abstract and the very concrete.
Yeah.
Very concrete discussion of form, of examples of form. Not airy-fairy.
No, very specific.
Very specific and concrete. And yet, there's always a moment for abstraction, for reaching into a kind of a philosophical stance that comes out of the form.
It was interesting to me to realize, or maybe I had known this before and forgotten, but that you had a background in philosophy as well, because that made so much sense to me, reading your essays.
It makes a lot of sense because, if you study philosophy or in the history of philosophy, so much of that is about recursion, repetition. It's like almost a poetic expansion of ideas. And then you sort of see the same thing happening in fiction. It's, I mean, now I'm getting very abstract, but this is very real to me, which is a sense that there's a form to thought, and then there's a form, and then literature itself is another form of thought.
Right.
And you start to abstract forms, and then things start to make sense to you in ways that they didn't before. That's why I wrote that book.
Yeah.
Or that, all my nonfiction books are basically the same book. That is, they're not repetitive because I deal with different topics, but they're looking at literature in the same way.
And I think that your collections of essays build on each other over time. I mean, it seems very much like a body of work, you know, created over a career.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. That's what it's intended to be. It's like each book is a chapter in a large book.
Yeah. Let's see. Do you mind if I quote something from early in your book and we can talk a little bit about it?
No, that's fine. Sure.
This is a pretty basic tenet of your teaching, but I think it's well summarized in this moment. It was within, I can't remember which essay it was in, but there's a subtitle of Plot, or the Sonogram of the Heart. And you write, "I think of a story as a composite text orchestrated around a dramatic plot. Plot is the backbone of a story, the first element of its architecture. Stories are dramatic. The essence of drama is conflict. A plot is a desire conflicting with a resistance over and over. The same desire meets the same resistance in a series of events, plot steps, that increase in intensity as they progress toward a climax, at which point the desire is achieved or not, as the case may be. Plot is recursive, rhythmic, and libidinal. It is a prime example of what I call homology in a story, in that the identical action, the same desire meeting the same resistance, is repeated again and again." Sorry, that was kind of a long thing to read, but I think it's important. And I wondered if we can talk a little bit about this. I think it's very important for a conversation of your work.
To a certain extent, there was a kind of progressive discovery. I mean, maybe some people know this stuff naturally. I don't know. But I, first of all, didn't understand plot as conflict at first, because I'm conflict averse. You know, I just was blind to it, that being what was going on there. I thought all stories were about young men having trouble getting girls and being depressed about it, which is what I wrote when I was very young. And I realized, no, there had to be another person there that, you know, it would help if the girl was in conflict with the guy and not just the guy thinking. But then I realized over time that really most plots, I mean, obviously there are experimental plots and there are variations of form, obviously. But in general, the basic form is a plot where somebody wants something and tries to get it again. It's the same action. That's why I use that word. I invent that term homology, which is the same or parallel action. What that means is that a story plot is actually very artificial.
Right.
And the art is often in making it not look as artificial as it really is. A story is not like real life in its focus and concentration on that particular conflict line. You know, in real life, you might have one incident where you're in conflict with your teacher in school. In a story, it has to be three or four times
right.
The same conflict.
Yeah, and the reason I wanted to talk about it is because I think, for you, having written about it for many years, it seems really clear. But I think for readers who aren't used to analyzing what they read, it may be a new idea. So that's just why I wanted to talk about it to begin.
Well, it certainly was a very new idea to me at the time, and I'm still excited about it in a certain level. I mean, every time I read a story or a novel, I take it apart. I mean, and I see this happening, or I see some variant of it happening. And if you see the essays, I mean, I'm looking at Jane Austen, I'm looking at Bithwell Gombrowicz, and you'll see that I'm taking them apart that way. That's part of the grid of analysis that I apply to any book.
One thing that I like about your essays is that you present what we need to know about these stories, but you don't put the whole story in your essay. You know, I mean, I think I've seen that in a number of books where the beginning of the essay is the actual story itself. And in a way, you're just able to kind of present it without showing that whole thing, and you just present what's necessary for us to see your points, which I kind of like.
Well, but at the same time, I try very hard to do a synopsis that is complete and implies the whole. I mean, I think there's an art to writing a synopsis.
Yes.
I didn't used to think that. I used to hate that. In high school, you know, they would try to make you write a synopsis, and I just loathed that. But I've come to be very excited about my synopses. There's an art. I mean, I'm writing one thing that I think is tends to be forgotten in looking at the content of these essays is that, in fact, I am writing essays, and there's a form, and it's a very artful form. I mean, I find all these essays really quite fun to write and read myself. I don't think they're for everyone, of course. But even when I was editing the magazine Numero 5, and I would have reviewers, I had to train each of my book reviewers to write a Numero 5 book review. There's a form, and it helps them grapple with the book. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
Very fun to do.
Yeah. Well, and that's a good point. I wasn't going to ask you about that, but as far as writing the essays, do you think that these all sort of follow the same form, or do you just have a way of approaching them and they vary a lot formally?
Well, they do. There's a certain sort of base structure that goes into each one. I mean, when one talks about form, it's so easy for the person who's listening to you to, you know, for that person's mind to stray into the word formula, because that's a much more contemporary and easy to understand term. But form is not formula.
Right.
Form is a kind of basic structure there to be elaborated and expanded and changed. So that's what happens. I mean, you mess around with the form, but the basic form is there. There you will find always a synopsis of the text. You will find an organization of the basic techniques, the basic and important techniques, and you'll find examples and discussion of examples. And then usually at the end of the essay, you find it moving into the realm of philosophy or thematic expansion.
Mm-hmm.
That's there in all of them. But then, you know, you have the Camus essay, which was actually, I was asked to write an essay about a book that I had read when I was young and that I...
Yeah, I loved that.
Came to later. So I had to, so that's the same form, but on top of that is welded this other form, which is a sort of memoir of reading when I was young.
Right. And I loved reading about the different takes that you had when you were, what were you, 16 or something versus now.
Right. Well, from the 18-year-old idiot to the 60-year-old idiot.
But it was fun because, like, all the subtlety is not noticed by the 18-year-old. All that's noticed is, like, this guy is about to be killed.
Right.
For...
No, I didn't. I missed everything. You just sort of read with your hormones at that age.
Right. Let's see. Your very first essay, and this is actually, I think, from page one, is The Style of Alice Munro. Do you mind if I read another little bit?
No.
Okay, so you write, "My sense is that she, Alice Munro, doesn't compose so much by reference to a notional reality as by dramatic antithesis. A statement provokes a counterstatement or a counterconstruct, subversion or complication, and the sentences, paragraphs, and stories advance by the accumulation of such contraventions." And I thought that was really interesting because, you know, we're always told to include conflict in our fiction. You know, Janet Burroway says conflict is what makes it interesting. But this was something else. This was like conflict actually creating the narrative move by move. Do you agree that that's sort of what you're saying?
Yes, on a certain level, yes. I'm always trying to, I mean, I'm not in this just to find out something and stay with it. I'm interested in getting deeper and deeper all the time. So, yes, conflict runs plot. Okay, but why, how do you write all the words that go around the plot? That's becomes an interesting topic. What else is going on there besides, you know, the plot structure and the plot events and that basic conflict? And then you want to, so what, How does Alice Munro make a paragraph? How does she make a sentence as she's describing plot? Okay, right. Then you start to look and you start to sort of see certain moves, and then, and again, the word form comes in. You can say moves or forms or gambits or structures, but you just see her doing the same sorts of things. And that doesn't make her boring or formulaic, by the way, either. It makes her immensely creative. I mean, form creates aesthetic space, you know, which you then fill with the imagination, and that's what she's doing. So you just see her over and over again. She very rarely leaves a character in a sentence by herself. She always adds another character and says, so-and-so is like this, but so-and-so was like this. There's a conflict. You know, there's an antithesis. There's a contrast. And that makes for writing excitement. That's why her sentences and her paragraphs and her way of telling things is exciting.
So right down to the sentence level, she's creating conflict even just within her statements in her sentences.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the conflict is of a certain sort in her. It's a kind of subversive conflict. She's always sort of making a statement and undercutting it.
Okay.
So there's a pervasive irony, which in itself is a contrast device. Irony is I'm contrasting one statement with another thought. I'm subverting the thought.
Yeah.
And that's what she's doing.
Okay. Now later you write about forcing the conflict meme. I wonder if we can talk about this, and also like how much of this is subtle and how much of it is overt in being done successfully. How do you keep it from being heavy-handed if you're going to force that conflict?
I meant to use the word force.
Right.
Well, to emphasize the fact that it's overt, I guess, just to say that, and to use your term, overt. It's in the words, so it's right there on the page.
Right.
Subtlety is a word that I can't imagine I've ever used in analyzing a text. It just goes against the grain because the writers are in there being obvious. Now, to the general reader, so your point of view, look at the point of view of who's reading and who's writing. I mean, for the writer, it's obvious, and for certain readers, it's obvious. For a consumer reader, and that's not to diminish the consumer reader at all. Where would we be without readers who just enjoy reading the book
right.
from end to end and then putting it away? A lot of this stuff is not meant to be read at the consumer level, and I think that the authors know that. I mean, they know that little two-word thing they put in there that delighted them and was what they worked on the whole day long, no one's going to notice. No one's going to, and as a writer, you know, I find it just lovely when somebody does notice.
Right.
But they don't, and you don't normally expect people to notice. So there's an accretion of these small but overt moments that go to make the power of a story or a book. Okay.
Yeah.
But I would not use the word subtle.
No.
It's obvious. And when I say a conflict meme, I mean words that refer precisely to the conflict, and those words are spread, are moved throughout the text so as to overtly focus the story on that conflict over and over and over again.
So when you are writing fiction, are you finding the conflict in your first draft and then revising toward this sort of form that you are looking for, or do you find that it's in the first draft?
Oh, when I write fiction, first of all, I've been writing for a long time, and so there were, you know, if you slice my life at a certain point, you'll find, like, early on, I didn't do it. Obviously, I had the young man being depressed, and that was what I thought a story was, and there was no conflict, and then I learned how to put conflict in. I used to put a little sign above my typewriter saying, "Name the enemy in the story." That was because I didn't do it naturally.
Yeah.
But then I got to the point where I realized, well, it had to be conflict. So I would have the conflict invented before I even had the story.
Okay.
I would just make lists of conflicted situations in a notebook. And then, and I would go through, and I'd find one that looked promising, and I would just start with that, and then go. So it's not as if I find it in the first draft. No, I myself start with a conflict and write the story around that.
Okay.
But I know that other sorts of writers pre-write, and it takes a while for them to identify what it is they're trying to write about. So, and that's a perfectly legitimate way of doing things, too.
So you maybe know the conflict, but do you know the plot?
No. Here's an example. I mean, I think I used to write down the openings of stories. That's how the conflict. So I had one that I wrote down one night. I was trying to work on husbands and wives, because that's a conflict node, as we all know. So I wrote, I thought my wife had left me, but she is back. What she has been doing the last 2 years, I have no idea.
Okay.
And so there's my conflict. It's husband and wife. The wife has left. She's come back. There's a sort of multiple avenues from that. But the main avenue was the questions of what she's been doing the last 2 years. I have no idea. That's what I went with.
Yeah.
So there's the plot of that story moves along the line of what has she been doing? How am I going to find out? And so it develops into a series of actions where he tries to communicate with her, but she won't talk. She's living in the house, but she won't speak to him. So that's all it is. The plot is just him trying to talk to her and her not talking.
What story is that?
It's called Story Carved in Stone.
Okay.
And I had to invent. So then I had to invent what she'd been. I didn't know any of this stuff. I didn't know where they lived. I didn't know exactly how the plot was going to go. I mean, I just thought communication. And then I didn't know where she'd been, and didn't know what the background story was. So I had to invent all that. It's kind of fun, and you don't know ahead of time.
Yeah. Now, you used to host a radio show, much like this one, in which you discussed books with their authors. And you must have heard this. This is something I hear all the time. I'll ask about something I noticed, and an author will say, I never thought about that, or I didn't notice it when I was doing it. So to some extent, I wonder if some of this is not intentional, or if narrative unfolds, you know, sort of organically towards some of this. Do you have thoughts about this?
I'm not quite sure I understand. You're talking about actual works of fiction.
Right. So I'll interview somebody about a work of fiction, and I'll say, you know, I noticed that, you know, your narrator says this thing, and then later you have another character say almost the identical thing. I don't know. I'm making this up. But, you know, I'll notice something that the author, him or herself, won't have noticed in the moment that they were working on it. Do you have thoughts about how conscious that might be, or if you ran across that when you had your show?
Well, first of all, though writers are, and especially great writers, are very conscious of what they're doing, they will inevitably, because it's a work of the imagination, because form is an empty space that you have to fill up with stuff that comes out of your head, there will be obviously unintentional things, unintentional inventions, things that you didn't intend that suddenly seem to work very well, and there will be things that you didn't even notice. I mean, that's the whole point of deconstruction as a methodology, is to look at a work and find out the thing that's there that the author didn't intend to be there. So, I mean, that happens, of course. And to a certain extent, you know, one tries to tease out some of those things. But that's not, the major aspect of composition doesn't work like that at all.
Okay.
So, you know, you can't, besides doing deconstruction, you can't sort of say that that's the way authors work. For the most part, authors are sitting there consciously thinking about things. They're learning the craft, consciously applying the craft, constantly applying principles of expansion and antithesis and so on and so forth. They know exactly what they're in that. In those stories that in the Alice Munro essay, I analyzed two stories: Lives of Girls and Women and Baptizing. Baptizing is a knockoff of James Joyce's The Dead. Now, when I say knockoff, that sounds like I diminish it. It's brilliant.
Okay.
Because she saw the formal variation. She understood at this stage in life when she was writing this, she understood what plot was. She understood the repetition of conflict. And then she looked at James Joyce's The Dead and saw that his variation of that was that there's three-step plot conflict, but the main character is a man named Gabriel. And he doesn't have a conflict with the same person. He has a conflict with a woman, and it's a different woman in each of the three steps.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a brilliant variation of plot structure. And what does she do? She does exactly the same structure. She has three different men, three events in her plot structure. And then, but what she does is within each step, each man in that story, she does a plot structure there. So she has actually three. It's a brilliant story. So it's like James Joyce squared.
Okay.
I know it's hard for the listener to understand that without having the story right in front of them. But whatever she invented that's unconscious, way more of that story is completely conscious. She looked at James Joyce's The Dead, and she was applying what she'd learned to her Southwestern Ontario short story about a young girl growing up.
That's a really important point. Like, I may be hitting on something that an author that I'm interviewing didn't notice that they were doing, but there, for every one of those, there's 100 things they knew what they were doing.
A thousand. They knew exactly what they intended to do. And also, of course, you know, well, as an author, you intend to do something and you don't do it very well for one reason or another. I mean, if you look at Jane Austen's Mansfield Park, she just screwed up the ending. And it's a confusing ending, and it's thematically conflicted. And what you see that a lot, because endings are really hard. But also in that case, her structural intentions were confused in her own head. And she was trying to write a romantic comedy,
right?
And at the same time write a serious book,
right?
And that's problematic.
Now, that's your example, that's your prime example for your essay, The Erotics of Restraint, which is the title essay in this collection. I enjoyed reading that. You wrote, for us, restraint is tantamount to repression. I loved that, because that's so true. You know, we've come to such a different place than early 19th century England. So I know we can't really summarize Mansfield Park, but we can talk about the erotics of restraint in writing and what writers might take away from your observations. I'm just wondering if you can talk about it maybe a little bit generally.
First of all, it's not exactly a pun, but it's a
yeah.
I mean, the book would have made more sense. The title of the book would have made The Aesthetics of Restraints. Or if I just said what it really means, which is The Aesthetics of Form. Okay, that's what the title really means.
That's not fun at all.
That's not fun. So, and besides that, and then I had the essay where I was playing back and forth between the two versions of the word restraint. So restraint is a pun there. It is, in fact, a play with the idea of bondage, because it's clear at a certain level that Austen's playing with the idea of bondage, restraint being erotic, especially for the men in that era. And as a woman who watched all this stuff, she knows what's going on. She knows that women excite men by acting under restraint. Anyway, it's absolutely there in the text. And so I got to play with the idea of erotics of restraint within that essay. And then it seemed to apply to form in general, because form creates story, creates art, which is libidinal, it's erotic, it's connective in an erotic way, and exciting.
Yeah. The flip side of that, the book I thought of with the regard to this subject was The Remains of the Day, where it's actually the man who's very restrained.
Right, but that's the part of that culture is depending on who, or any culture, I mean, depending on the point of view of the story, the restraint comes into play, and then becomes eroticized and fetishized.
Right. Well, it's...
The British were very good at that.
It's denial of desire, and desire is so important to story, as you said from the start.
But it creates a conflict right there, see, at the level of the personality, moral or ethical restraint.
Yeah.
As opposed to what you want, which is what's going on in Mansfield Park. It's moral, ethical restraint of the heart.
Right.
In some way.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Let's see. What are you working on next, Doug?
I'm actually working on a novel on the side, but I'm most taken up with a book of, I call it a family memoir. And it's about my slave-owning ancestors, my great-great-great, I have to count them out, it's four greats, uncle Walter owned plantations and slaves in the West Indies, and was a thoroughly reprehensible character.
Mm.
And not much was known about him. In fact, the family story was, didn't know anything about him, really. But I've gone back and found the documents and records, and I'm putting together the story of these people and their friends and their the people that they knew. It's the trouble with slavery as a concept for people in the 21st century is that it's kind of distant past, and it's covered over with a lot of popular opinions, and you don't get to look at exactly what was going on, and that diminishes the idea for both the slaves and the white people involved. So I'm just trying to resuscitate that for myself.
So in a contemporary context, it's been oversimplified, sort of, down to the
stories. Well, it's not just oversimplified. First of all, of course, there's a huge amount of scholarship that goes on around slavery, especially in the United States, that's actually wonderful and keeps rediscovering things. But it's, on the other side of that, there's people who, the vast majority of people, don't think about it very much and think about it in a very popularized way. So then we get movies about slavery with, you know, first of all, there was the Gone with the Wind kind of idea of slavery. And then now we have the popular idea of slave violence. I don't know. The popular idea is just never a very good idea. And so the work of any writer is always to bring up the reality at some level.
Yeah.
To remind people.
Now, so I am surprised that you even knew about this person. I mean, great, 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 great uncle. How did you know? I mean, do you have a family that keeps a lot of records, or like a family Bible with the whole thing all spelled out, or?
So, sort of, I mean, it is a, we have a, we are a family of, first of all, we're people of a of the diaspora, various diasporas. So this huge chunk of the family was United Empire loyalists and had to leave the United States and come to Canada. And that kind of traumatic experience makes you remember things.
Okay.
And then they were Scots, and the Scots remember things too. So the two sides of the family. But in any case, there was a family story which was all wrong, which partly made me want to check this out. Was that we had this story that my great 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 grandfather had owned the slaves, and the family liked to tell the story that he was the youngest planter in the British Empire to be indemnified when he freed his slaves. The British government paid them to free their slaves. And so when I looked that up, it wasn't true. It wasn't true at all. And so I had to find out the truth. And the truth went back to his uncle. And his uncle was the prime slave owner. And then I had to, you know, I've been done research in Edinburgh and London. And you find these. You find records.
Yeah.
And wills and... in fact, last week, I found a book, an autobiography written in 1830 by a man who actually met my great-great-great-great uncle.
Oh, that is interesting.
And describes him and describes conversations with him.
Oh, wow.
And describes a conversation that my uncle is having with a slave. And it's there in this book. It's quite amazing.
Goodness. Yeah, that is amazing. Have you ever done any genealogy before, any research like this?
Oh, yes. I mean, I'm all my life.
Okay.
You know, it's a family fetish.
Oh, okay.
And my mother made me do it. It's all my mother's fault.
Everything is, always.
Yes.
Well, that sounds fascinating. Okay. Now, I always like to ask my guests what they've been reading lately that listeners might enjoy hearing about.
Oh.
That's often the answer.
Right. Reading a very dry... Okay, no, what I've been reading that the listeners might find very interesting is that I've been immersing myself in West Indian literature.
Oh, okay.
And man, it is fascinating. It is good. There's this French... he's from Martinique, so he's French-speaking and wrote in French. But Edouard Glissant, G-L-I-S-S-A-N-T, brilliant. There's a novel of his called The Overseer's Cabin that has been translated into English. It's wonderful. And I would read with that great Grenadian novelist who now teaches in the United States, Merle Collins. She's written a couple of novels that are just brilliant.
Okay.
And what is interesting about these people is that they are writing in response to Faulkner. Glissant wrote a book about Faulkner and very much sees Faulkner as a Caribbean writer, a writer obsessed with plantation culture, which these Grenadians are obsessed with plantation culture and the implications for the later generations.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so you can see the influence of Absalom on Glissant and Collins. I find it fascinating.
Oh, wow. Huh. Okay, great. I just have one last question. So I always like to ask my guests for advice for writers at the end, and I thought I would ask you, how do you suggest your students go about, first of all, reading? How do you, like, present ideas about how they should read more carefully? And also, how do you suggest they go about using these ideas as they, you know, have aha moments reading your essays, using these ideas in their own writing practice?
As a reading practice, I mean, in her journal or her diary, I think, or an essay, I can't remember anymore where I read this, but where in Virginia Woolf I read this, but Virginia Woolf said that she didn't know how anybody could read a book without a pencil in her hand.
Mm.
So you should be... And I can't understand people who don't write in books. I mean, a book is there to be destroyed in loving it, you know.
I take it you don't have a Kindle.
No, I do that. No, you have. I have several book readers and that allow you to make notes on your computer. And yes, absolutely. And then I use that. Oh, I'm obsessed with this stuff. Zotero, do you know that program?
No.
Zotero, Z-O-T-E-R-O. It's a program. What it does is you can take a PDF of a book or an article, and you can mark it up in an Adobe program or an Adobe knockoff. And Zotero will take out the quotes that you've marked and have them in a separate file for you.
Oh, wow.
And so that you can then use them in your... You can put them in an outline and use them, you know, as a guide to your work, or quote them in your work, and so on and so forth.
Oh, that's cool.
So you can mark up the book, but then you can mark up anything on a computer as well. I use a reader called a Mobi Reader, which allows you to keep quotes, bookmarks, and notes as you're reading a text on a computer.
Yeah.
So all that stuff, anything you can do to mark a book up, preserve quotes, make notes, note repetitions. Reading a book on your computer can be very helpful in terms of finding repetitions, because if you start to see something repeat and you didn't know where it was, you know, you thought that it had repeated before, but you didn't remember,
Right. Then
you can just run a search function. I did that when I was writing my book on Don Quixote.
And you probably found a lot.
Yeah, I found things that I actually didn't notice. I had an intuition, I ran a search, and all of a sudden there was a pattern.
Yeah.
So that's one bit of advice. What was the other part of the question?
So the other part of the question is, like, as they undertake a writing practice, as students of yours sit down to write, you know, you said earlier, form isn't formula, you know, and it's like, how do we take these ideas that are so interesting and apply them to our work And maybe that's too hard a question to actually get specific about, but...
No, it's actually not. It's first of all, there's just a plethora of forms, and they are at the level of the sentence, and they're at the level of the large structure of the whole work. And the trick is, first of all, start to become aware of a form. Mm-hmm. Don't totalize. Don't be a fascist about this. Just find one thing. It can be a small thing or a large thing, and then, in order to incorporate it into your writing, you have to start. You have to start trying to, and you'll just screw it up and be very wooden the first few times you do it. That's fine. You expect that. And you do that along with continuing to read and seeing the same form in other people's work, not just the first place you discovered it, but another author's work, so that there's back and forth between reading and writing, and trying to apply things consciously. And especially when you have a problem, you know, if you have a weak passage, I do this all the time. If something's just kind of weak, I look at it and I just apply various obvious formal things that I've learned. Okay.
Yeah.
And I'll just say, okay, I'll put in a but construction. I'll put in a list. This will get better.
It will not be subtle.
And it will not be subtle, no. But no one will notice that.
Great. Okay, that's great advice. I'm just going to mention again, the name of the book is The Erotics of Restraint, Essays on Literary Form by Douglas Glover, published by Biblioasis. Thank you, Doug. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure here, too.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Vermont author Douglas Glover. You can learn more about his work at his website, douglasglover.net, and you can also find a few previous conversations I've had with Doug on the podcast site, which is writethebook.podbean.com. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. And I hope you have a great week.